Sea turtle rescue effort is nearly complete in the Gulf of Mexico. 130 of the endangered creatures were captured when a cold snap threatened their survival. 90 have been released back into the waters in the past 48 hours. The rest are still being treated by marine biologists. A New England fishing crew has netted what is thought to be the largest squid ever caught. The colossal squid is an estimated 39 feet long and 990 pounds. The cephalopod is headed for the New Zealand National Museum. Cisco Systems and Apple have reached a settlement in the Cisco trademark infringement battle over the iPhone name. The two will agree to share the name and work together, nor the details have been released. AT&T says it signed a five-year billion-dollar contract with General Motors to supply the automaker with global networking services. The contract is one of the largest in AT&T's corporate history. Nestle says its profits last year jumped 14%. The world's biggest food producer credited a boost in product prices as well as cost-cutting costs. Clothier, Abercrombie & Fitch posted a 20% increase in quarterly profits. The company cited a boost in sales from its Hollister line of shops that appeal to teenagers. And light sweet crude is trading at $60.06 a barrel on the New York Mercantile Exchange. And on Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones is down 58 points, the NASDAQ is down 4, and the S&P 500 is down 3 points. More at QualityNewsNetwork.com. I'm Jay Galay.
And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. People are still talking about yesterday's show. If you haven't heard it, it's posted on my website at radioinsidescoop.com. It made a lot of people some upset, some very interested, some confused. That's okay. That's part of what I do here on the Inside Scoop. The question was whether the 9/11 truth movement has some people that are leading the charge that are basically trying to confuse the issue to hide the real questions. And I want to encourage you to check that out and also on the Dreams End blog. After that show yesterday, I think some may have questioned my bona fides as a liberal, as a progressive, as someone who's not a big fan of the administration. Let me be clear, and maybe the best way to do that is to have today's show. Today's show is actually beyond impeachment. Many have talked about impeaching the President and the Vice President of the United States, but as I know, as you know, certainly I know, having worked as an attorney in the House of Representatives, impeachment is a political thing more than a legal thing. It's under a law, it's under the Constitution, and it's supposed to be based on law. But impeachments are inherently political. They're based on politics, whether it was Andrew Johnson 100 and so years ago or Bill Clinton just a few years ago. And we just don't have the votes. Even if we got the majority of the House to impeach, we would never get two-thirds of the Senate to convict. But there's another case to be made, and one that isn't often made about George Bush and Dick Cheney, and that is a criminal case. Many of you know that Bush and Cheney cannot be indicted. They cannot be put in prison while they are President and Vice President of the United States. At least I believe that's the case. I'm going to ask my guests in a minute. But maybe, totally apart from impeachment, they can be charged with crimes. I've invited a guest today, a former federal prosecutor. Her name is Elizabeth de la Vega, and she's the author of United States versus George Bush et al. And in her book, she makes a case to a hypothetical grand jury for a criminal indictment of both George Bush and Dick Cheney for conspiracy to defraud the United States. Ms. De La Vega, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Oh, well, thanks for having me.
So, apart from impeachment, which we know is political, you think that we can actually make a criminal case against the president and vice president?
Well, actually, no. That's not what my book says. I hate to start off disagreeing with you, but
no, that's okay. Go ahead.
Radio. First of all, what I say in the introduction to the book is that I'm laying out this case to show that the Bush administration has committed a crime, and my purpose in doing that is to make it clear how important it is that we do take action, and so whether that action is impeachment or indictment is really not the point. It's just that we
But you're saying that you think, as a federal prosecutor and a former federal prosecutor, I understand you're not actually making this case, but you think that you could persuade a grand jury to criminally indict Bush and Cheney. Isn't that what you're saying?
Maybe that's not
what you're saying. I don't know. Please fill us in.
Well, I lay it out in the introduction to the book, and what I say is that there is actually overwhelming evidence that this administration has committed a crime. And, of course, as people who study civics know, we can't indict a sitting president. But given that we know there is a case that they have committed a crime that's far worse than the Enron fraud, really, my purpose is to educate the public to make it clear that we can't just walk away from this. So,
okay, well, let me ask you then.
Congress, I don't actually agree with you about ruling out impeachment right off the table.
Okay.
I don't think that's appropriate. But
when I say ruling it out, let me just be clear. I think the president should be impeached. I have said that on my show.
Okay.
What I'm saying is that politically at this time, counting votes, counting noses, as we do on the Hill, being practical, I think we just don't have the votes right now. I'm not ruling out impeachment. I'm just saying that it can't be done politically at this time.
Well, that's actually the whole reason I wrote the book. I don't think it's appropriate to say what the end of a process is before you start the beginning of the process. So when I wrote the book, we didn't even have the majority in both houses. But I wanted people to understand that this is such a serious matter. It's the kind of thing that people do get prosecuted for around the country every day, every week. And knowing that, we can't say at the outset, well, we're not going to do anything about it. So I think what we really need to have are hearings, and I think they very well could lead to impeachment. Because one of the things that Barbara Jordan said when she introduced the articles of impeachment in the House was that it's not appropriate to decide in advance whether you're going to take this process forward based on what you think the votes are going to be, because you haven't had the hearings, you haven't had the investigation.
Okay, that's a fair point. And of course, as a prosecutor, you would go about it the way that you go about all crimes. You don't presume guilty. What you do is you presume innocence, and you present it to a grand jury to show probable cause. A grand jury is a group of American citizens. People don't talk much about a grand jury too often because they meet in secret. People are more focused on what is called the petit jury or the trial jury, the one that rules against a criminal. But a prosecutor goes before a grand jury and presents probable cause to argue that a crime has been committed, and that begins, the grand jury then renders an indictment, or they decide not to indict, and that if they do indict, that begins the criminal process. Let me ask you, as a prosecutor, what crimes do you think you could present to a grand jury that Bush and or Cheney could be indicted for?
Well, there are a lot.
Okay,
so
let's give a list.
What they could be indicted for, the question really is, what crimes is there evidence that they have committed to a degree of probable cause, because we end up with that issue about the Constitution and the President and so forth.
Right. Understanding that while they're in office, they can't actually be criminally indicted.
Well,
I understand that.
Okay. Well, the first one, and the one that I wrote, which is the subject of the book, is conspiracy to defraud the United States. And what that is it's in the criminal code, 18 U.S.C. Section 371, and it prohibits conspiracy, by the way, is just an agreement to commit a crime. I know that you know that, but many people in the general public think of it as kind of off-the-wall concept, which it's really not. It's just a very neutral term. And so,
right. They use it because of how it's used outside of the legal context. People talk about conspiracy theories and so forth. Even I talk about that. That's not the legal context. You're absolutely right. The legal context of conspiracy, it's just a crime. It's a crime like murder or solicitation or any other crime. Okay, go ahead.
Right. And so the part of the statute that prohibits defrauding the United States applies to situations where people, it doesn't matter who they are, they could be citizens or they could be members of the executive branch or anyone, where people use deceit or any form of fraud to interfere with an agency or branch of government. And so in this case, the branch of government would be Congress. Now, people say, well, Congress should have known better. But the focus in a fraud case, and that's probably true, by the way, Congress should have known better. But the focus
that's a totally different question and one we've raised many times on this broadcast. But let's leave that aside for now.
Right. But the focus in a fraud case is the conduct of the people who are the perpetrators of the fraud. And so the test is whether, in this case, it would be whether the Bush administration used various forms of deceit, and it's not just lying, which is an important thing that I lay out in the book. A lot of people are confused about what fraud is. They think it's just lying, but it's much more than that. It's any form of artful misrepresentation. And whether they used...
I was just going to say, so if I try to sell the Brooklyn Bridge to someone, even if they don't believe me and even if they don't accept it, I can still be convicted of fraud.
You could be. You probably wouldn't on that.
Probably because people might think I was joking, but if I were actually serious about it and I really tried very hard to get people to believe it and it wasn't seen as a joke, then I, you know,
right.
People rely. Okay, fair enough.
Right. So the crime would be using... What I lay out in the book is really a massively orchestrated fraud relating to not only the grounds for the war, but so many other factors. For example, whether they had actually decided to go to war before they even announced they were going to have a dialogue about it. Or also what are called material omissions, leaving out important information that people would need in order to make a rational and fair decision. For example, suppressing information about the cost of the war or the number of people who or number of troops that were going to be needed for the war. So that is really the overall crime that I address in the book, U.S. versus George W. Bush.
Now, but, Mr. LaVega, in the past, certainly we've had presidents that have lied to the American people and lied to Congress. The Gulf of Tonkin incident comes to mind in Vietnam. There's certainly many, many other examples. We have to take a break, but when we come back, I'd like to address if you believe that George Bush and Dick Cheney are unique in that a criminal case can be made against them, or do you think that any time the government lies about something, intentional lies, I mean, actually defrauds people in order to get people to do something, you think that's a prosecutable offense. If you want to call in, folks, you can join in the discussion. It's easy to do. Just pick up the phones and dial 877-4-HEAD-ON or 888-488-MARK. We'll be right back after this.
The United Brotherhood of Carpenters and Millwrights are problem solvers. They accept any challenge and approach every project with the highest of competency and training. UBC has thousands of professionals who can be at your service giving you the best in business anytime and every time. It's their job to provide manpower. They build partnerships based on respect and trust. They provide skilled, responsible millwrights and carpenters to meet the challenge of any project because they believe and what they're doing and are so very committed to getting each and every job done right. They include a clause in your contract that eliminates work slowdown and jurisdictional disputes because they believe that, as professionals, they can discuss and solve any problem while keeping your project on target on time. We'd like to take this opportunity to thank the men and women of the United Brotherhood of Carpenters and Millwrights for building the American dream and saving the American dream. Thank you.
Do you believe the environment is issue number one? Does the idea of genetically modified food cause you to lose your appetite? Do you prefer green over greed? Do rising sea levels and vanishing polar ice cause you concern about our planet and what we are doing to it? Would you like news with attitude on the environment, organics, renewable sources of energy? Well, then join me, John Fox, for Foxed Up. Weekdays 5 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Pacific, 10 p.m. in the UK, and 9 a.m. here in Sydney. where conversation radio becomes conservation radio, and we turn it straight up to 11, right here on the Head On Radio Network.
What would happen if you didn't follow the established path? If you did the unexpected? Would you feel scared? Proud? Relieved? Could you explain that helping the people of Peru improve their own community would also have an effect on your own? Or assisting an entrepreneur in Ukraine to launch her small business? Or creating a support group in Malawi for children orphaned by AIDS? What if you established your own path, one that others might follow? Would you rather make your own way or spend your life saying, what if? Life is calling. How far will you go? Peace Corps. To find out more, call 1-800-424-8580 or go to peacecorps.gov.
From Washington, more of the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. My guest is former federal prosecutor Elizabeth de la Vega, the author of United States versus George W. Bush et al., a fascinating book that you can get on Amazon. There's a link to it up from my website at radioinsidescoop.com, which makes the legal case for the criminal indictment of George Bush and Dick Cheney. It consists of arguments that she would make to a grand jury if she were attempting a criminal indictment, understanding that as president and vice president, they can't be criminally indicted unless they're impeached. Ms. La Vega, I wonder what are the arguments you're making, though, conspiracy to defraud the United States, and I have no doubt that that's exactly what they did. Is this something that most presidents do, and you could make this argument against most presidents, or do George Bush and Dick Cheney stand out?
Well, the answer to that question actually is yes to both.
Okay.
Or not. It is probably true that we could make this argument as to most presidents, but to me that's almost really an irrelevant question because the people that we have now in this administration are Bush and Cheney. And so in the same way that you could make that kind of argument about somebody who commits murder, for example, there are always murders. There are always robberies. So it's not really an argument to me as to why we shouldn't do anything in this case. And in this case, we know that we have absolutely egregious behavior on the part of...
Lay out the facts for me. I'm sitting here as a grand jury, so are my listeners. If we're sitting here, how would you lay out the facts in the case of United States versus George Bush et al.?
Okay. Well, it's kind of a whole concept thing, but what you have is a massive campaign that started, we don't really know precisely when it started, but we know that the earliest date it started is sometime around August or September of 2002. At that point, the administration claimed that it was starting a quote-unquote open dialogue about the war, whether to go to war in Iraq. But at that point, it's very clear from things that are declassified, the war had already started. And by the way, of course, it's never been declared a war. It's an invasion and an occupation. But as of September and August of September 2002, Bush had already gotten first a preliminary war plan request in September of 2001, a formal request in November of 2001. They had five revisions of the war plan, and they had a final plan already in effect as of September 2002. We had already moved funds from Afghanistan appropriations to Iraq appropriations, $700 million, without any notice to Congress whatsoever. We had 40,000 troops over there. We had 350,000 tons of munitions over there. And Rumsfeld had already authorized 50 airstrikes likely to kill more than 30 Iraqi civilians.
So, okay, they had planned the war, obviously, ahead of time, before...
Not only did they plan it, they had executed it. They had started it.
Why is this fraud important? The president says he wasn't decided on going to war, that war was only a last resort. What about the argument that, heck, he was sort of planning, he had the troops there, they were ready to go, but they could still be called off?
They started. When Rumsfeld approved 50 airstrikes likely to kill more than 30 people, that means they did them. They were executed. But beyond that...
I'm sorry, there were airstrikes executed prior to the congressional authorization?
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
All right.
And beyond that, this concept of an open dialogue. Now, when you look at this fraud, there are kind of generalized fraudulent assertions and specific ones. And one of the generalized ones was this theme of having an open dialogue with the American people. And it seems the way you're suggesting, you're implying that it's fairly innocuous, but the truth is that the polls at that time showed that the American people did not support this war. But if they were asked, well, what if the president consults with the people? What if he consults with Congress? What if he goes to the UN? Are you more likely to support it? Then that kind of took them over into majority. So that was a very calculated theme of the campaign to sell the war. They had
to go through the emotions of democracy, going through
exactly. And a very cynical ploy. And then Bush had been for months, starting with his January 2002 Axis of Evil speech, trying to imply to the American people that Iraq was a danger. Of course, that was fraudulent as well, because the National Intelligence Estimate, in effect, at that time, said no such thing. But people were saying, even Lieberman, who supported the idea of going to war, was saying, well, there's all this saber-rattling, and where's the beef? You know, where's the evidence here? And so what they did at that in the summer is they organized the White House Iraq Group, which is made up entirely of PR people. It was not a group designated to discuss whether to go to war, but rather a group designated to figure out how to get people to go along with it.
Andy Card, in fact, said, we can't sell the war in August. You don't bring out a new product in August.
Right.
And he waited until September of 2002 to sell the war.
And, in fact, in that very interview, Karl Rove was a participant in the same interview, which was published in the New York Times on September 7th. And another thing that one of them, I think it was Karl Rove, said was that we are essentially rolling out our campaign to market the war, and we are directing it to Congress and to the American people with the goal of having Congress authorize the use of military force in October within 5 to 6 weeks. And in the end, it will be difficult for anyone to vote against it. Now, what that is in the terms of criminal law is really a statement of intent to conspire. It's an expression of their intent to conspire to defraud the United States, because if they had used the truth, of course, in their marketing campaign, there would be no fraud. But here,
Mrs. Vega, let me ask you this, because I don't think anyone will dispute that that at least not in my audience, that they lied, that the intent was there, that they wanted us to go to war, that they were trying to sell us on going to war. I mean, the president has sold us on other things that were complete lies, like on the Social Security system, completely apart from war. What is it that makes the difference between a president selling a policy based on, let's face it, things that were untrue? And what makes it go over the line into criminal activity, in your view?
Well, what makes it go over the line is that it was untrue at such an egregious level. I think the premise of your question is that you're assuming that it's okay because other presidents have done it in the past, that we should look aside when these presidents or these officials do it. I don't accept that assumption. The difference between now and, say, Vietnam is that we didn't know at the time what was going on. And when people did start finding out, it was the Watergate burglary that led to the impeachment, but really much of the Watergate burglary, the impetus for the impeachment at that point, was really the president's conduct in deceiving the public about the war. So we have, I am focused on what we have now. And I don't accept the premise that it's just because elected officials are also politicians that that entitles them to lie to the public. And, in fact, the law does not accept that premise either.
Well, what is the law on conspiracy to defraud? And can you defraud the United States? I mean, this is...
Well, that's what I explained just a few minutes ago. The law is that if you set about to use deceit to interfere with the deliberations of Congress, for example, that is a violation of 18 U.S.C. Section 371. And, in fact, H.R. Haldeman in the Watergate era was charged with that very crime. People in Iran-Contra were charged with that crime as well. So that is what the law says.
And was Haldeman convicted of that crime? I'm just curious.
Pardon me?
Was Haldeman actually convicted of that crime?
Yes. And in Iran-Contra, the charge was upheld by Judge Jessel, but the case had to be dismissed because the Reagan administration refused to turn over the classified information. But the basis for the charge and the fact that it was a valid use of that crime in that context was upheld by the court. So, yes.
Is this in layman's terms what people call lying to Congress? Do people often talk about the fact that Ollie North was convicted of lying to Congress and that it was overturned on a technicality because, in fact, he had been granted immunity? Is this the charge lying to Congress that people talk about, or is that an entirely
different
charge?
The one that was overturned was lying under oath to Congress, but this is directed more broadly at the public and Congress, but it was the clear goal of it was to influence the authorization to use military force, the obtaining of it in October of 2002. And, of course, they did get that authorization to use military force, and they used a number of different methods of deceit in order to get it. One of the most egregious ones had to do with these aluminum tubes that they came out with talking about in early September. And at the time that Bush administration officials went out talking about these tubes, saying that they were only suited for use in a nuclear centrifuge, there were 14 different reports out there that had been in effect since April of 2001, 15 months of reports. And out of those, 12 of them said specifically, this is highly disputable. It's highly in controversy. And then half of those from our own nuclear weapons experts from Lawrence Livermore and Oak Ridge and also the State Department said these tubes couldn't be used for nuclear weapons. So that's just a specific example of...
Another example would be, of course, the 16 words that Scooter Libby is on trial for. The British have learned that Saddam Hussein is seeking significant quantities of uranium from Africa. Totally untrue. That, of course, led Dick Cheney to go out and even disclose the covert nature of Joe Wilson's wife as a CIA agent in order to try to put down that critic. And that trial just had closing arguments yesterday. We're going to take another break. 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. If you want to call in, ask some questions of our distinguished guest, former federal prosecutor Elizabeth de la Vega, do not hesitate to do so. You can also comment on the blog at RadioInsideScoop.com. We'll be right back after this.
Sweetie, I love you, but those jeans have got to go.
Yeah, I know. Grab me a pair next time you go to the store, would you?
No.
Huh?
I'm not going there anymore. I can't stand it.
What do you mean?
It's just awful, honey. The only smile in that building is that big yellow face. Everybody else looks miserable, and I can't find anything there that's made in our country. That bothers me.
Well, nobody makes clothes in America anymore.
Au contraire, mi amigo. There's a ton of American-made clothing at No Sweat.
Well, where's this No Sweat store? Out at the mall?
No, silly. I found them at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. There's a link there. I already ordered some great workout gear, and I also got you some new jeans. They'll be here in a couple of days. Surprise.
HeadOnRadioNetwork.com?
Uh-huh. Just click on the No Sweat banner. You're right there. Helps union workers and helps support America's other liberal network. Cool, huh?
I knew listening to the horn was a good idea.
Whose idea?
Your idea, dear. All the good ones are.
Union made? No sweats. Great prices? No sweats. Great looks? No sweats. No sweat at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. Click the banner. Do the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
recently on the Guy James Show on the Head On Radio Network.
If you have tuned into this program by mistake right now, and you are a Republican, a right-wing Republican specifically, before this program is over, I do want to warn you, you're going to think that I'm the devil. You're going to think I've got horns and a red cape because I hate the Bush administration and everything they stand for. So be warned right away, okay? You're all warned right now that that's where we're coming from today.
Don't miss Guy James, weekdays, 3 to 5 Eastern Time, on the Head On Radio Network.
Here's a little test for you. Identify the following water-saving devices around your home. Using water wisely is important, since our growing population puts pressure on this limited resource. Ready? That's water-saving device number 19, your outdoor faucet. Check faucets, sprinklers, and hoses for drips or leaks to save water and money. That's your toothbrush, water-saving device number 54. Turn the faucet off while you brush and save up to 25 gallons a month. It's water-saving device number 11, your water bill. If it's unusually high, you could have a leak. Learn to detect and repair leaks by contacting your water provider. Last clue? That's BeWaterSmart.net, a helpful website full of water-saving tips from the Water Conservation Coalition and your local water provider. There are a number of ways to save water, and they all start with you. Water. Use it wisely.
From Washington, back to the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. My guest is former federal prosecutor Elizabeth De La Vega, the author of United States versus George W. Bush et al. Ms. De La Vega, give me a list, if you would, and it may be a long list, but of the crimes that you think a prosecutor could possibly get a grand jury to indict on.
Well, I think one would be the sanctioning and promotion of torture, which is a violation of both the Geneva Convention and enacted into law as a violation here as well. And we actually have the son of Charles Taylor, the former dictator of Liberia, who's under indictment by our own Department of Justice for that very thing in Florida. Another one is the illegal spying. The president has admitted that he violated the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act by conducting illegal surveillance without going through the FISA court. Another one would be, now this is not actually a crime that I know of, but it certainly is an abuse of power that provides ground for impeachment, which would be the signing statement. I don't know where that would fit into the criminal code, but to me that really is the last straw as far as the president goes, because he has essentially admitted and done many, many times. I think it's close to 1,000 times now.
It's more than all other presidents put together, his
right.
signing statements. And it frankly reminds me nothing so much as Richard Nixon's comment to David Frost that when the president does something, it's not illegal. That
right.
seems to be what his signing statements say. Yes, I'm making this law, but I don't have to follow it.
Right, right. It's as if he's signing the law with his fingers crossed behind his back or something.
Exactly.
And it's just a blatant expression of defiance of the law, which you asked me before, what is so egregious about this administration? And that really is kind of the final bit of evidence that puts it over the top, because at least in the past, I guess you'd have to say, I know Nixon did make that comment, but he ultimately seemed to recognize that he had violated the law and had
he did resign.
Grace to resign, right. But here, this administration doesn't seem to think any of the laws of this country apply to the members of this administration.
Let me ask you about some other things. Extraordinary rendition, which is a very calm-sounding term for what it is, which is taking people that we can't prove have committed any crime in the United States and sending them to a foreign country to be tortured, as happened recently with Maher Arar, a Canadian citizen mm-hmm. who was sent to Syria. Does that violate any criminal laws?
I'm sure that it does. and I don't have it at my fingertips. But clearly, people in the United States are not allowed to kidnap people and send them to a place where they know they're going to be tortured. I mean, that would be under the rubric of sanctioning and providing a scenario where somebody could be tortured, which would be aiding and abetting.
It's just kidnapping. I mean, that's
kidnapping.
A crime.
It's kidnapping. And your point about this calm-sounding term is a really important one in the context of this whole administration, because this is what they've done over and over and over again. They've come up with these terms that people get inured to. They get used to the idea. Oh, extraordinary rendition. That doesn't really sound like that big of a deal. Or, you know, the terrorist surveillance program. Well, what that is really is blatantly violating the laws relating to the rules of surveillance. And
yeah, kidnapping and torture or extraordinary rendition. Which sounds worse? I don't know. They don't sound like they're identical, do they?
No, they really don't. They really don't.
What about Guantanamo Bay? Is there anything there that you think it could be criminally sanctionable, or is that just the president, you know, breaking the law but with impunity?
No, I think that's also criminally sanctionable. We have people who have been held there for years and years and years, and then after the fact, the administration has gotten this law which purports to give them immunity for whatever they've done, but I do not believe that that law would be upheld as constitutional.
Let me go to the phones, if I could, Mr. LaVega. I have Eric here from Vermont. Eric, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Hi, Mark. How are you this afternoon?
Doing good.
Doing good. I've been listening to your excellent guest, and she seems to be a very knowledgeable lady. Unfortunately, she's much more knowledgeable than I am.
Well, then ask your question, if you will.
I have a question here. It has to do, and maybe I've missed some points that you've made, ma'am.
Mm-hmm.
It does have to do with the realistic possibility of impeachment rather than to go directly after a criminal indictment after impeachment or during the process and so on and so forth. I'm not really clear how, in terms of the Constitution, we can justify to the American people, considering the media is going to spin it this way and that way and so on and so forth, and is this another little blue dress with a whatever? I'm not really sure exactly how that's going to get the people behind really acknowledging and get out of the denial of...
So, Eric, is your question sort of how is it legally done, practically done, or is your question how do we sort of do a media campaign to persuade people to do impeachment? Sort of two separate issues. I don't know which, or maybe both.
Maybe both. Okay. Know, I'm sorry. I'm not.
No, that's fine. No, those are good questions. Let me see, because I can answer the political end, certainly, given, you know, I used to work on the Judiciary Committee, which begins articles of impeachment. The House Judiciary Committee,
yep,
where I used to work, has to draft for it to actually happen in a legal constitutional manner, totally apart from the politics of it. They would have to draft articles of impeachment. They'd have to be for high crimes and misdemeanors. The Constitution does not define high crimes and misdemeanors, but certainly the things that Elizabeth de la Vega has been talking about are, in my view, high crimes and misdemeanors. I mean, kidnapping and torture doesn't sound like a low crime to me. The articles of impeachment would have to be passed by the Judiciary Committee, and which is a majority of the Democrats today, given the Democrats control the House. It would then go to the floor of the House, and if the entire body of the House, if a majority of the 435 members there voted for impeachment, then the president is hereby impeached. But that's not the end of the process. Then it goes to trial, quote-unquote, in the Senate.
In the Senate,
according to the Constitution,
need 67 votes.
That's right. You need two-thirds of the senators
votes.
Present. And that's exactly right. And that's what they did to Bill Clinton. They actually did impeach him.
Oh, yes. I was there. I watched the whole thing. And
they just didn't convict him.
No, they didn't want to convict him because they were worried about Gore coming in there and replacing him. Sure,
that may be true. Okay. Eric, let me address the second part of your question to Mr. LaVega, and thank you very much for calling in.
Sorry.
Mr. LaVega, let me address, I've given the legal answer, but let me ask you the political answer, which is, by your book, are you calling for hearings? How are you trying to influence,
yes,
I guess, the political end to persuade Americans that Bush and Cheney have to be impeached?
Right. What I say in the book is that it seems as if we're kind of paralyzed in this no man's land. I'm using that in the tennis terminology, not the war terminology, but, you know, in between the baseline and the service line, and where we don't know what to do. We have this political issue, we have this legal issue, and people are really paralyzed. They don't know how to act, don't know what to do. But it seems to me, having spent all these years as a prosecutor, that the most compelling thing for people are the facts. And up until now, even, we haven't had in a format that people can really get their hands around what the facts are. Because when you hear things on TV, and your show is obviously an exception, but many radio shows, you just have people just shouting at each other. So to me, the most important first step is to get these facts out. And the people we need to do that are Congress. We need Congress to take action and do its job of oversight. So my thinking is, I am very process-oriented. Congress is the group we need to do the oversight. And from that evidence that is adduced at these hearings, we can't prejudge what the outcome will be. But it seems to me that the evidence is so overwhelming that if people are being objective and being fair, there really is no other conclusion other than to find that there are impeachable offenses. And for people to worry about what the ultimate conclusion is going to be, I think is really jumping the gun. Because even though we've had impeachment proceedings before, we've never had a president actually removed. Impeachment is not the removal. It's the entire process. And that's right. What the Constitution set out as the remedy for abuse of power. And if these actions on the part of this administration, with the pre-war intelligence, the torture, the signing statements, the illegal spying, and it gets kind of, people start to glaze over. There's so many things. But the fact is, if these acts are not impeachable offenses, then as Barbara Jordan said in the time of the Nixon era, we might as well just throw the 18th century Constitution into a modern day shredder, because we don't have, there is no such thing as an impeachable offense.
Mr. LaVega, and I realize that the Democratic Congress has been in power for about 6 weeks. It's obviously very, very early to judge them. But do you feel like the people that are the new chairs of the committee, people like John Conyers, Henry Waxman, are they gearing up to do the kind of oversight you'd like to see, or do you think that they need to do more?
I think they are gearing up. I certainly would appreciate it if it went more quickly. But it hasn't been very much time. And I don't think it would be appropriate, would have been appropriate for them to come in and, you know, right out of the box say, well, here we go, we're starting into impeachment hearings. But I think that the momentum is growing, really day by day. And one of the things I believe is going to possibly turn the tide is the information that has just come out in this forum of the courtroom in the Libby trial, because that information is something that Congress can take regarding Cheney, regarding the actions of the National Security Advisor, the Deputy Secretary of State, and the President's Chief of Staff, the Vice President's Chief of Staff, all going out, misusing intelligence and going after somebody who was a critic of the war. Now,
Be specific, because I've been following the Libby trial, as have many of my listeners. It is a fascinating trial. What evidence do you think has come out specifically at the Libby trial that could be the basis for either a criminal indictment or impeachment of the president or vice president?
Well, just referring to Cheney, for example.
Okay.
There is an unbelievable amount of evidence that indicates his involvement right from the very beginning. I'm just going to start in June because that's really what the focus was in the trial, but there's actually evidence that precedes it. But he is the person who, in June, right when Walter Pincus, the Washington Post reporter, was talking about doing an article and asking questions, he's the first person who told Libby that Valerie Plame, or that Joseph Wilson had a wife who was in the CIA. He was the first person who seem to seize on that as some kind of issue that would have some relationship to how they were going to go after Joseph Wilson. And he is the person whose office came up with these talking points through Kathy Martin, his press aide, and they were disseminated. And the talking points that were used regarding the Wilson's wife and so forth match identically the notes that Vice President Cheney had on the op-ed article. And actually, Fitzgerald went through that almost bit by bit in the closing argument. So,
do you think Fitzgerald's going to go after Cheney? I mean, Libby being the smaller fish to get the bigger fish? Is this case over after Libby's conviction or acquittal? Or do you think it, first of all, do you think it will go further? And secondly, do you think it can go further?
I don't think, he certainly hasn't announced that it's over. Fitzgerald hasn't said that the case is over. But I also don't think that Congress needs to wait to find out if it's over. I think it's really incumbent upon Congress right now. I mean, there are so many instances where we have parallel civil and criminal investigations. The steroids cases, the pretexting that was used by the companies out here in Silicon Valley. Congress is always willing to jump in, or often willing to jump in, to do their own parallel congressional investigations, even though there's a criminal case. And if this isn't the case where they should do that, I just can't imagine that there would ever be one.
Well, speaking of Silicon Valley, we have a caller who's from pretty close to there. Dave, welcome to the Inside Scoop. Dave, are you there?
Can you hear me?
Yes, I hear you fine. Ask your question, please.
Yes, Mr. Alavega, I'm very much like what you're saying. And I think as I'm putting it together, the harm that is coming at this country and its people is at such a pace that we really, the world cannot wait. I think that all these awards to no-bid war profiteer contractors has literally emptied our treasury, and it's continuing. I think they're overcharging Medicare to a point where they want to bankrupt it. They'd like to take away Social Security. We cannot be patient. Why is it that Congress acts like they don't know that this is all going on? It's very, very troubling.
Thanks for your call, Dave. Let me address that to Mr. LaVega. Is Congress hiding from these charges?
I don't know. I know that there are many people in Congress who are conducting hearings, and there are people in whom I have a great deal of faith. One is Henry Waxman.
I like him. I used to live in Los Angeles. He used to be my congressman, and is one of my favorite people in Congress. I hope he lets the subpoenas fly, let 1,000 subpoenas bloom, to mix metaphors here.
Right.
With
right.
China.
Just along with those cherry blossoms out there. You
Exactly. Let me ask you about Dave's other point, and that is war profiteering, which is a different element from the other ones that we talked about, torture and kidnapping and spying. I mean, if Halliburton, as we know, I mean, Cheney gets money from Halliburton, if it can be shown that the president or the vice president, or both of them, are funneling taxpayer dollars into entities that then provide, whether in, you know, campaign contributions or otherwise, money back to Bush and Cheney, can we charge them with anything, with bribery or war profiteering or anything like that?
I don't know if this – I think you mentioned this to me before, that this may be a legal form of bribery, but regardless of whether it's actually a crime, it is clearly an abuse of power. Because this is a really quick example. When you work as an assistant U.S. attorney, you're told that the rule is if something is going to be more than $20 as a benefit to you from somebody who's involved in a case that you have, say a defense attorney wants to buy you lunch,
right,
you don't do it. And it's really very clear-cut.
So maybe $8 billion in bricks weighing 360 tons might be a little more than $20?
Yes.
just a little more, right?
Right.
Just a little, maybe $40, a little bit more.
It's been amazing to me. And then we have some woman who was in the Department of Justice who was overseeing environmental cases that involved oil companies, and she bought a $980,000 condo with some official at Phillips Conoco. Now, that's a clear
What's her name, and what's happened to her? She's still in office?
Off the bat, but right off the tip of my tongue. But
That's is she still working for the government?
I think she is.
Let me ask you this. You're a former federal prosecutor.
Right.
We just did a show actually on Tuesday, I think it was. Folks can listen to this. Listen to my debate show on Tuesday at RadioInsideScoop.com, where I debated with a Republican about all the firings of the U.S. attorneys across the nation. Mm-hmm. For political reasons. Many of them were prosecuting Republicans, including down in San Diego. They were prosecuting Duke Cunningham. In fact, the Deputy Attorney General of the United States lied and said it was because performance reasons. In fact, only one of the seven had any performance problems whatsoever. At the end of the day, I guess it comes down to practicality. You're a former federal prosecutor. Our federal prosecutors, though, are being drummed out of office by the same people that they would prosecute. So how, at the end of the day, can you ever prosecute a crime when the prosecutor themselves is under the control of the President of the United States?
Well, this is my point that I keep coming back to. This is why we need Congress. And the only way we got a special prosecutor in the Libby case was because Congress put pressure on. And they said, there is a direct conflict of interest. You have John Ashcroft, who... for whom Karl Rove worked in a serious capacity in his and Ashcroft's election, overseeing this so-called investigation of Karl Rove. So it all comes back to Congress. And what I have been telling people around the country, and I was just at an impeachment forum in Washington, by the way, Olympia, Washington, where there were 850 people. And I'm going to another one tonight where there are going to be 600 people. The people, just like Molly Ivan said, the people in this country are the deciders. And making people's opinions known has a value in and of itself, even if nothing ever comes of it. But certainly just saying, well, something's off the table or Congress isn't doing anything isn't an excuse for people not to say what they want to have happen.
Let me ask you this. You're a former federal prosecutor.
Right.
If you were still...
I was
just going to ask you that. If you were still a U.S. attorney, would you be forbidden from saying the things that you're saying right now on air?
I would be...
would it be an ethical violation? Would it be against your job to talk?
Yeah, it would. I would.
So the only reason you can talk is because you're an ex-prosecutor. I mean,
right.
Current prosecutors who might consider this, they couldn't talk about it on the radio.
No, they couldn't. No, because anything you say when you are... currently employed as a federal prosecutor would be in your capacity as a federal prosecutor, unless you're talking.
So let me ask you this: who would, if someone were to proceed with a criminal indictment, and I know that, for example, with Richard Nixon, they had him as an unindicted co-conspirator. They couldn't indict him while he was still president, and then, of course, after he resigned, Gerald Ford pardoned him, so they couldn't prosecute him then. But he was, in essence, although unindicted, he was accused of being a co-conspirator, doing exactly what you're accusing George Bush of doing, engaged in a conspiracy.
Right.
It was a different conspiracy, but a conspiracy in Bush's case to defraud the United States. Could a prosecutor today declare Bush or Cheney an unindicted co-conspirator before some secret grand jury? Could that happen today? And if so, where would it happen? Would it be the U.S. Attorney in the District of Columbia?
In the Libby case, I think it's even possible that Cheney could be charged as an indicted co-conspirator. Because the same...
Can you indict a sitting vice president?
Yes. The same rule doesn't apply to the vice president to the president. And that's why, I mean, I have no inside knowledge of Patrick Fitzgerald.
Right. I understand. We're speculating here.
Yeah, he made it very clear in the closing argument. He said there's a cloud over this administration. And that was a fairly unsubtle comment about...
And he even said a cloud over the vice president. He didn't just say the administration. He was specific. He said there's a cloud over the vice president.
Right.
So would Fitzgerald have the authority to indict Dick Cheney?
Well, I'm sure there are a lot of legal difficulties because there are issues of executive privilege and all kinds of things and immunity. So it's not a clear-cut thing, but I also don't think it's ever been decided to the point where it's impossible.
Would he be the appropriate one, or would I don't even know who it is, but the U.S. Attorney of the District of Columbia or some other person be more appropriate to Fitzgerald if someone were to pursue such an indictment?
Well, I think Fitzgerald would be the only possibility right now because he is a special prosecutor, or special counsel is the term that applies to him. So he doesn't have to get approval from the Attorney General. But anybody else, see, the thing about the firing of the U.S. attorneys that's a little bit misleading in the way the story's been presented is that the U.S. attorneys are not really independent in the first place. They're not completely
They work for the president, right? Yes. And, of course, in the Watergate era, there's the famous example of the Saturday Night Massacre where Nixon didn't want a special prosecutor investigating Watergate, and so he actually ordered his attorney general to fire the special prosecutor. The attorney general refused. Bob Bork, solicitor general, finally did the firing. Elizabeth LaVega, an hour goes very fast when I have a terrific guest like yourself. I want to thank you very much for coming here on The Inside Scoop. And ask all of you to check out her book, United States versus George W. Bush et al., at Amazon.com. There's a link from my website. For now, this is Mark Levine signing off.
America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Hey there. How's everybody doing today? Glad to have you along with us here. Just making a joke on the chat room with Mark Levine. I don't know if he gets it or not. Hey, welcome to the Guy James Show here on the Head On Radio Network. So glad to have each and every one of you along with us today. Hope to have a good show for you. Coming up around 3:30, we got Raed Girard coming with us. Going to talk to us about those snappy little oil contracts. All the Westerners here are trying to get, extract all the money from the Iraqis, the American and British oil companies. Take all the money away from the Iraqis. That's the deal, and always was the deal in the Iraq War. Hey, glad to have all of you along with us today. Yes, indeed we are. We've got some interesting things to talk about. Want to thank the whole gang over to Head On Radio Network and Democrats.com, DemocraticUnderground.com, all the folks over at UnreportedNews.net. Glad to have all of you along with us today and some of our favorite websites. By the way, be sure and check out our new website. www.theguyjamesshow.com, and you can take a look at the new fresh look we have up there. Maybe you like it, maybe you don't. I don't know. I do. It's something different, and good to freshen things up now and then. Got some new links up there, some new audio put up today, and we'll have some new comments put up for you in the next day or so. So happy to have all of you along and checking out the new website. I see quite a few hits on it. Glad to see that. And thanks to Ben over at WhiteRoseSociety.org. Without Ben, well, you wouldn't be listening to me right now, that's for sure. So Ben and all the gang at HitOnRadio.net, John Fox, Jeff Allen Wolf, Mark Levine, Dr. Bill, Joe Vecchio, Bob Kincaid, the whole group over there. We got a great lineup for you here in the Head On Radio Network, and the network is growing, solidly growing, and we're happy to report that to you. As we mentioned yesterday, some in total, liberal radio didn't do so well last year, but our network is growing, and we're very, very happy about that. And, of course, we're indebted to all of you, our important listeners. You are the ones that we're doing this for. You're why we do this. Believe me, it's not an easy task. I had a little conversation with Jeff Allen Wolf a little earlier today. It takes it out of you. Jeff does 3 hours a day, no interviews, no phone calls, 3 hours a day of him. Hey, I don't know how you do that. I'll tell you what, I'm certainly not up to doing 3 hours a day with no calls, no nothing in there. That's a tall order, and it's a lot of work. May not seem like it to some of you, but believe me, doing like Jeff does, sitting behind a mic 3 hours a day, that's a tall order. Really is a very, very tall order. So congratulations to Jeff for that. Where are we at here today? We're going to we have the official Guy James Show puppies in the studio today. I hope they behave themselves. Didn't have the babysitter today to leave them home, so we brought them into the studio. And as long as they behave themselves, okay. But if not, I I don't know what the answer is. We can put them out in the lobby, I guess. It's not that big of a lobby, but we could put them out there. Kind of an echo chamber, though. Little Yorkies. And you just don't know about Yorkies. Sometimes they behave, sometimes they don't. Very mischievous, little curious little animals.